And that was really based upon a known anatomical and neurophysiological system, in that the respiratory rhythm was really affecting the vagal pathways from the brainstem to the heart.
Welcome to another episode of Brain, Hope, Reality, PTSI, not PTSD. I have the absolute honor to having my excellent friend, Stephen Porges. I think he should have gotten the Nobel Prize a long time ago, I think, in physiology.
Let me interrupt that for a moment. I would take friendship over a Nobel Prize any day. So thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
You're an amazing man. Thank you. That's an interesting answer. I think your knowledge of vagus nerve and all of that implication is pretty impressive. You have introduced him to some amazing people, which actually had a huge impact on my life. Everybody, my wife is into yoga, and everybody in yoga world think you're very much close to a deity, as much as I. It's interesting to see how a true scientist can actually become demigod next to Buddha.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you don't mind, what I wanted to kind of have a quick conversation with you.
Sure.
And just because it's such an amazing ability to be able to talk to you about polyvagal theory, and a lot of people throw that term around, I think, without really understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the honor of staying with your home, and I got to see, you know, some of the work you've done through various species, how you got to that. So I'd be very curious to understand why you got even interested in this, because your degree is psychology.
Right. Well, there's actually two different pathways. There's a pathway of how I kind of figured it out, but there's another pathway how it was really related to everything I've ever done in my life and what I'm still doing. So it's kind of like, you know, your science starts to support your intuitions about what it is to be a human. And I think that becomes a real interesting story. But there are a couple very interesting things about this journey to kind of put together this, quote, polyvagal theory, which means many vagi. And the point was, I was studying back in Chicago, high-risk babies, you know, in neonatal intensive care units. And this goes back actually to the 1970s. And there was this kind of paradoxical situation in which a risk factor in preterm and high-risk babies is bradycardia. The heart rates have a precipitous drop. It's like a reaction to hypoxia. And so there's, in a sense, the body adjusts to lack of oxygen, and it just slows.
Just because people who are going to be listening to are not all medical.
Yeah.
Bradycardia means slow heart rate.
Yeah. You can insert at any point in time.
You have to put in some basic information.
Yeah, thank you. So the issue was, you know, I you know, it was kind of like in the background knowledge that the vagus is involved in clinical slowing up the heart rate, meaning it slows up too much. So it's not like slow heart rate is bad, but if it gets too slow, it can't support the oxygen needs or oxygenate blood to the brain. And so it's an interesting reaction. So I was studying something else in the heart rate pattern in babies, and that was the rhythmicity of heart rate changes with breathing. And that was really based upon a known anatomical and neurophysiological system, in that the respiratory rhythm was really affecting the vagal pathways from the brainstem to the heart. So the vagal pathways were literally going on and off based upon the phase of the breath. So when you inhale, heart rate would go up because the vagus would literally be withdrawn. And during exhalation, the effect of the vagus gets stronger. And the vagus being this massive cranial nerve that goes from the brainstem to the heart and basically to all many other organs of the body. So it's not like it's just a heart pathway. So I was, in a sense, floating with this insight that if I could make available to the neonatologists and the people working with high-risk babies, a methodology of measuring this vagal influence to the heart could save babies. You know, the physicians would be alerted to when this neural circuit was changing. So I published a paper in a journal called Pediatrics, in which I kind of like was pushing this point of, respiratory signs, arrhythmia, the respiratory rhythm and the heart rate is being vagal and this being protective. Well, I got a letter back from a neonatologist, and these are the moments that that change how you think. Because what the neonatologist said in the letter, he said, really a very interesting work. He said, however, when I was in medical school, I learned that the vagus could kill you. And what he was referring to was the bradycardias. And so now I was struck with what I call the vagal paradox. How could the same nerve be involved in supporting health, growth, restoration, our homeostatic functions, and also kill us? And so I started to try to figure this out. And the information literally was coming from, initially came from comparative neuroanatomy, which tries to estimate evolutionary trends, especially in vertebrates. That's what I was interested in. And what you start to find out is that mammals have two different areas in the brainstem linked to the vagus. One in the dorsal or back of the brainstem, which primarily services the organs of the gut and below the diaphragm, and the other, which goes more ventrally to the front of the brainstem, which is linked to an area of the brainstem that regulates the muscles of the face and head. Right. And because it's interacted with the face and head, when we are in this calmer physiological state, our faces are more calmer, more expressive, our voices have greater intonation, and literally we can hear human voice better because the middle ear muscles work. So what it actually ended up doing was creating a spotlight saying, this is the neural changes that occur between reptiles and mammals. And that is the function of the vagus on the heart is now broadcasted in face and voice. And of course, that becomes the roots of our social behavior. And also ingestion uses the same neuromuscular. Okay, cutting the story short is within the past decade, I learned some more information. And that is, if you studied embryology, you literally can see the cells of origin of that newer ventral vagus leaving the dorsal vagus and moving ventrally. They just move forward. And different mammalian species have different distributions of dorsal vagal fibers that still influence the heart. So if you're a species of prey, you have more cardioinhibitory, meaning vagal fibers that can slow your heart rate, coming from that dorsal area than if you're a predator species. So if you're a predator species like a dog or a cat, you stick an electrode into that area, no change in heart rate. But if you're a prey species, you're out, you're gone. You basically pass out. So this comes into what we're going to be talking about really is, who are humans? And I start saying that there's complications, because it's not merely this, quote, genetic program of moving ventrally. It's also the effects of prematurity. It's the effects of abuse and trauma. It's the effects of all these interruptions.
Interrupt, Stephen, if you don't mind. Because, yeah. Again, this is more for a general audience. I mean, I find all this amazingly interesting. But I think one of the things you're saying is that, so freeze response.
Right. Prey, the freeze is the adaptive one. Now, right. Here is the part. When I built the theory, this issue of freeze was really modeled on a reptile freezing.
Right.
And a reptile freezing doesn't even breathe. So it's like, but mammals, when they freeze, it's kind of a hybrid state in where that dorsal vagus and the sympathetic nervous system are often both working together. So it's like I'm maintaining enough muscle tone so I don't pass out, but I can't move. But the interesting part in the world of PTSD is when you start talking to people, PTS, excuse me. I got it. No, well, I live in that world. So the issue is we have to be very careful about the words we use, because they pathologize what we will, from a polyvagal lens, are basically normal adaptive reactions. There's a lot of the features of PTS are basically adaptive reactions to life threat. The body does that. It's not a disease. It's an adaptive function. Now, what we'll get into is, can we get people out of being locked into that state? That is the therapeutic question. But what I wanted to get at is really that the physiology of immobilization, which is the category that I really want to talk about, has different combinations of sympathetic and dorsal vagus. So the reptile just stops, doesn't need to breathe. It just immobilizes and will also, in many situations, just defecate. Because if you can get rid of the metabolic demands of digestion, you can hold your breath longer. And if you investigate people who have had life-threat situations, often the experience is below the diaphragm in the gut. So they may have loss of bowel. It may be part of their own experience. So we know that this dorsal vagal bit is very much involved in the immobilization response. And when we start going into PTS histories, clinical histories, where individuals adaptively dissociate, that becomes even this really remarkable adaptive feature of a nervous system. So let's start off by saying that in situations, for some, their bodies may literally collapse under life threat, meaning they stop breathing, the whole system goes into this shutting down. But that is not, that's time limited. You can't do that for many seconds. So the body, if it's repeatedly under these types of challenges, starts to adjust. And what does it do? It starts maintaining sympathetic tone. So you don't move, but you have enough sympathetic tone to keep oxygenated blood in your cortex. Then what happens if it's repeated and repeated? The nervous system may adjust, and this may be dissociation, where it no longer has to go into a challenged autonomic state, but the mental experience is now dissociative.
That's, I mean, so let me just, since sympathetic is something I am very interested in, as you know. So the vagus nerve will make it stop moving. And then you're saying the sympathetic gives you enough, you know, whatever circulation. Is that because of just vasoconstriction or something else?
Well, it's also, it's pumping blood through your system.
It's the heart and pushing.
Yeah, the heart. It's not merely vasoconstriction. If you surge with the dorsal vagus and it's now overriding the sinoatrial atrial node, if you have like a species of prey, the body just will not have enough metabolic resources to support its own life. So you have to, in a sense, utilize sympathetics. This gets into this other state. And why not stay in a fight flight sympathetic state forever? You can't support it. It's metabolically too costly. So the body in itself, if it does that, it will trigger this compensatory shutting down.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, here's an interesting side question, since this is more of an interactive thing, but I'm still, every time I talk to you, I learn something, so thank you. But, you know, I don't know if I told you, but I treated a dog with PTSD. They call it VPTSD, veterinary PTSD. So it's pretty easy to give PTSD to a predator. You just need to abuse it enough.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound like the vagal difference between prey and predator. In that sense, it doesn't seem to make a difference from my perspective as far as developing PTSD.
Okay, so let's hold on to that. Let's deconstruct that.
Sure.
Because your portal into PTS,
right,
is really a sympathetic perspective.
Correct.
No question. And it's not a total shutting down perspective. So
right.
it's really a perspective of, in a sense, high levels of anxiety, high levels of motivation. The body doesn't feel safe enough to be calm. And so you basically are turning off a sympathetic flow. And that, of course, would work with a dog. That's not a problem.
Right.
And the point is, the dog may be a better model than a mammal of prey. So dogs may experience PTS symptoms more similar to humans, which are going to be more reactive, aggressive, protective, proximal.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. All right. So the way I look at the world is interesting. So one other discussion you and I've had a lot, especially around my kid, we talked about that when somebody is depressed, the flat faces. Can you talk about the mechanics?
Yeah. So when I was mentioning this ventral migration, If we actually went for the ride with the vagal nuclei, or source nuclei that have left that dorsal area and now move ventrally, we're saying, why is this going on? What is this all about? And the what is the function of that? Let's not even talk about the selective aspect or the evolutionary processes, but we know this happens. And what does the organism gain by having this ventral migration of vagal nuclei that, or cardioinhibitory vagal nuclei that go to an area of the brainstem that regulate the muscles of the face and head, and controlled in ingestion, controlled in listening, facial expressivity, vocalizations, you know, in a sense, how we make contact to the world. And the answer is this really becomes the root of how mammals have always interacted, because mammals were not like reptiles. They were not isolates. It was always about some level of interaction. And the mother-infant interaction is really where it starts off with. You have this degree of interaction and reciprocity. So a preterm baby whose face is now flat because the neuroregulation of those muscles aren't there, guess what mothers and fathers often say about the preterm baby? They say, I love my child, but I'm not sure if my child loves me, because the child is not giving the reciprocity of intonation of voice. And when we talk to parents of autistic individuals, what do we hear? We have the same statements. I love my child, but I'm not sure that my child loves me. And what they're really saying, the child's not giving the reciprocity of facial expressivity, intonation, attention that the parent's nervous system craves. And when we talk about our pets, dogs, or cats who respond to our voices, what does that? That puts a smile on our face. They're, you know, and what I'm now saying, this you might like, I think we should not treat our children as if they were dogs or puppies. We should treat them as if they were cats, which is that cats aren't, a dog's goal in life is to make you feel good, literally. And we expect our children to have that same agenda in life. And when they look away from us, we feel hurt. And when we feel hurt, we say, oh, I'm now vulnerable because I love my child. I love my pet. And why is that pet looking at me? You know, and so we have a bodily response. And actually, I call that biological rudeness, because our body treats it as if it's a threat signal, rudeness. Now, when we have cats, we kind of make this, we accept what a cat is. And a cat is a cat. And when, so we had cats before we had kids, and then we had kids and we had dogs. And I hadn't had a cat in over 40 years. And we got this big cat at 17 pounds, a rescue cat that's sitting in the chair behind me. And I have learned what, from a cat perspective, using polyvagal theory, the cat loves to be around me. But when the cat had enough of me, the cat's gone. And when the cat is often gone, if you look carefully, you realize the cat can still see you. The cat is already knows its relationship. So the cat is using you as a co-regulator. It's difficult to use the cat as your co-regulator. Likewise, the cat wants to go on the porch. Yes. But when the cat wants to come in, the cat wants to come in, let you know. So you start seeing this very, you're being, in a sense, we think we're being exploited. We're being given permission by the cat to support their state, their physiological state, to enable.
Pardon? Care about your state.
Nah. But children don't either, what I'm really trying to say. And well, or often don't.
So it's interesting, guys. I was having a conversation with my wife about that. And yeah. She made a comment, something. It's like, you know, this really made me feel like this. And I said, you know, not everything is about you, honey.
well, the interesting, so what I started to think about is my good friend and colleague, Ed Tronick, developed this still face paradigm, and where a mother interacts with her baby for around 2 minutes and then freezes her face. And the baby goes ballistic because the baby, yeah, anticipates the interaction. And what's interesting is the recovery when the mother reengages. What happens to the baby? So we quantified the intonation of the mother's voice. Was the mother's voice more prosodic, more melodic, or was it more monotonic? And then we looked at the baby's heart rate and behavior. If the mother's voice had more intonation changes, more melodic, the baby's heart rate calmed down rapidly on re-engagement, and the distressful behaviors dropped out. But if you still engage the baby without this intonation, no effect on the baby.
That's fascinating. So can you tell me, kind of applying kind of the same rubric to people on the spectrum?
Yeah. So if we, in a sense, using the term spectrum, is you're talking about autistic spectrum and not trauma spectrum. Correct. Well, basically, if you think in terms of basic problems in mental health, there's some core principles across many diagnoses. And the core principle is that the social engagement system, the neuroregulation of the facial muscles, the intonation of the voice, the reciprocity and social interaction are all compromised. And that's because those facial features, that voice, are reflecting the autonomic state of the individual. If the autonomic state is in a state of defense, meaning more sympathetic, less ventral vagal influence, forget it. The cues are not going to be there. So a scared child, basically a frightened individual, an angry individual, is not an easy person to interact with and to co-regulate with.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So on an unrelated note, I've done on this here for many years, as you know. Yeah. So Ted, I've had a number of people who had all the monitors on them.
Yeah.
Put an IV in, and they would have the vasovagal episode.
Yeah.
The heart rate goes way down, and the blood pressure drops. And sometimes I had to give atropine twice, which would be the dorsal of vagus. What happens physiologically, you think?
Physiologically, this in polyvagal terms, that's the clinical bradycardia that we would see even in preterm babies. And the theory emphasizes, or at least suggests, that should be related to the dorsal vagus. Right. The problem with that, it's hard to document that because there are still dorsal vagal fibers going to the heart, to the sinus atrial node, but not a lot. The current literature is clear that the dorsal vagal fibers will affect contractility and blood pressure. So that fits into a vasovagal. A drop in blood pressure will result in the change in heart rate. So the question is it affecting merely the heart's contractility, the blood pressure, or is it affecting heart rate directly? And functionally, you don't care. You're getting, the body is responding into this shutting down system. Now, what polyvagal theory is, it gives you a hierarchy of how the system works. And that hierarchy is that the autonomic nervous system invertebrates didn't just appear as a complete system across all vertebrates. It actually has a sequence in which it had evolved, and that sequence is replicated in embryology. So in a sense, our own development from an embryo starts to literally relive the stages of vertebrate evolution. So it's kind of really an interesting bit. You start off with the most primitive, evolutionary most primitive vagal circuit, which is the dorsal. Then the sympathetics come on. And then at about 30 weeks gestational age, the ventral vagus comes on. And that really starts the preparation for ingestive behaviors and also for communication with the mother. So in a sense, if babies were born like preterm babies, most of them would have been rejected by their mothers, because the mothers would not find a connection with it. In fact, within the neonatal intensive care units, I would say the biggest breakthrough over the past 40 years is the research and training of staff and parents about the uniquenesses of preterm babies, so that parents can literally see a temperament, see an identity, and not see them as just not really being there. It's very interesting that once you train a staff into being understanding the reactivity, the sensitivity of the preterm baby, even though the face may not glow like a full-term baby and the voice may not carry it, the interactions change. They become more supportive.
So I've had opportunity to be involved in care of preterm babies, and that's sometimes very scary. So let's say there are 32 week of gestation baby.
Yeah.
Do they typically become typical from your perspective?
I have this comment. He's at 32. I'm saying, oh, no problem. And this is something that's changed over the decades. So like when you were in medical school, 32 may have been a real risky age. Now, if they weigh over 1,000 grams, people just kind of like, eh. Or if they're over 30 weeks gestational age, no, the survival is fantastic at, let's say, over 30 weeks gestational age. And 32 is really, for survival issues, a minor risk. Now, the next question is survival is one thing. There are two other basic features. One is cognitive function. The other one is social behavior. Now, so I've had this very interesting series of opportunities because I have this long research career where I touched all these different special populations. And I was on giving a talk. It was actually in Rome. And one of the people on the program, a woman I knew quite well, comes up to me and says, I want to talk to you about my daughter. I said, tell me about your daughter. She says she was preterm. And I said, how preterm? It was 26 or less. And the young lady was now in her 20s. So, I mean, this is good. So I said to the mother, how is she doing? And of course, what's the first response you get from a parent whose child has, let's say, social difficulties? They say, oh, very bright. She's very bright. I said, okay, tell me about, I mean, this is the story where I talk to parents of autistic kids. The first thing they say is not, oh, what a sweet kid. He says, very bright kid. So then I look at them and I say, okay, tell me what the problem is. So the issue, what she said was, so she said she's very bright. She does well in school. Then I asked the real question. Tell me about her relationships.
Not so good.
The response was not a clue. So you know what happened. So this is part of that individual's trajectory. She came into the world too soon, and the system was now challenged. The social engagement, the facial expressivity, the intonation of voice was literally dormant. And, you know, now the body, rather than being able to support and grow these systems to myelinate these pathways, was more challenged with survival. And this does not mean that you can't recover it. And this is part of what I think you really want to know is, can you create context in where you can recover these systems?
Right.
And in fact, I was involved in a project at Columbia with a colleague who was doing this very intensive sensory experiences with preterm babies. But what I was looking at was metrics that I had developed. And it was not merely the vagal regulation of the heart. It was another metric called vagal efficiency, which is how effective that vagal pathway is in regulating state. Think of it as autonomic flexibility.
Yeah.
And you could see it develop, and you could see that the intervention changed the slope, made it develop better. So I'm very optimistic. If you have endpoints, you know what you need to get to, and you have pathways that you're really triggering with neural exercises. And I bring the word neural exercise, and this is also in the world of PTS, in which I see it as really being characterized by individuals' bodies making an adaptive reaction and being locked in that adaptive reaction. So the body being locked into a state of threat, it worked well at the moment, but the body didn't get the message, let's say the nervous system didn't get the message to basically give up the defense. And I think we can build parallels with that with long COVID. If we think about long or chronic pain, which you're more familiar with, these long COVID is the body won the war, killed the pathogen. But did the nervous system get the message that it no longer has to defend? When we talk about chronic pain, is there structural damage? Is it, you know, acute pain we understand reasonably well. Chronic pain is different. Chronic pain is really the nervous system anticipating or thinking that there is damage. I would say thinking isn't the right word. The word is it's reacting as if there were. So it's somewhere in the information communication flow. It didn't get the message that the tissue damage had been healed.
Let me ask another question. So a number of people that I treat have PTS or PTSD or PTSI, whichever term you want to use. But they say they go into kind of, they have no emotions. and they freeze. They say we live in freeze, but actually they're walking, so they're not fully frozen.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. So I've treated a number of people, actually, who've had, they have their emotions back after the stellate, which is really interesting. So I'd be curious to see the interplay between activated vagus and sympathetic.
Okay, so we have to go back to anatomy for a moment. And what is the true role from when you're in medical school? What do you learn about the vagus? What's the primary function of the vagus? It's a sensory nerve. Most of the fibers are sensory. It's a surveillance system of our organs. So it's part of the feedback loop that helps support the homeostatic regulation. It's the optimal regulation of our organs. And when people say they're numb, and this is what you're describing, numbness, they're turning off the feedback from their body. And when they do that, it's not merely it's in the head, I don't feel my body, but literally the neural pathways are no longer communicating the same information. So it distorts the feedback loop, and then you start ending up with, in medicine, they would call it functional disorders. And in the world of trauma, it's frequently the gut. So people will talk about functional GI disorders or functional neurological disorders, which are also frequent in PTS. And these are, I would call them adaptive strategies of numbing the feedback loops, and this is the consequence. And
I agree with that completely. So if let's look at a brain for a second. I'm curious to see. So what actually happens neurologically?
Neurologically, there's this. I'm going to basically go through this again because people who are doing vagal nerve stimulation,
right?
That's they're stimulating the afferent branch of the vagus. So right. They're sending information that would normally be coming from organs. So the question is, can they duplicate or estimate the feedback from organs that are telling the brainstem that everything is good? So it goes up the sensory pathways of the vagus.
Right.
Now, it's all part of one nerve pathway, but within that nerve, there are these different fibers.
Right,
and
right.
Most of them are sensory, and they go to a special nucleus in the brainstem that you may have grown up with, nucleus tractus solitarius or nucleus of the solitary tract.
Right, right.
And this primarily, we can talk about what it does. So it gets the sensory information. It's now in the brainstem. And now there's a job of distributing that information. Some of it goes literally reflexively to the dorsal vagus. And so you can literally map vasovagal reflexes, which like if you wanted to puke, you stick your finger in your mouth or you press on your eye, optovagal reflexes, they're on basically one neuron going and triggering another and you have the reflex. Now, the other part of that is, so they can go to both the nucleus, the ventral nucleus, or they can go to the dorsal, or they can go to both. The other part is they can percolate upward. And this is where the world of the insula cortex, the mapping of the internal body on the insula as it moves up higher into the higher brain structures. So in a sense, our internal physiology is being mapped through the vagal afferents, which are now sending information and mapping it again into the morphology of the insula, and that's affecting different cortical areas. So the metaphor I like to use, rather than going into kind of like strict anatomy, because anatomy is in its own way dissociative and in a way disrespectful of the experience. In a way, we can say that when our bodily feelings are percolating up to the brainstem and they go up to the cortex and they're literally being grounded or wired together with our cortex to our body in the insula. So it's like being metaphorically grounded to our body. And we can start thinking about people who aren't grounded to their body. That means there's a numbness. Now, what happens with that numbness? It's not merely those organs are not really optimized by the appropriate feedback loops to support health growth and restoration. But the information is not getting to cortex to send signals to the cortex that it's not under a state of threat. So it's like the ability to, as I said, problem solve, to be intuitive, to be spiritual, to have, in a sense, this broad array of emotional experiences, intellectual experiences, requires the body not being in a state of threat. It makes a lot of sense because of the priorities.
No, absolutely. You're trying to survive. So let me ask you this question. So very close to that. So I know something about insulin, not as much as you, of course. But where does, so emotional numbness, I mean, numbness of the intestines, you know, heart, whatever, it's one thing. How do you connect that numbness to emotional numbness?
The connection on that is, once we understand that emotions reside on top of our brainstem, they are not, emotions are, in a sense, how we make meaning, or it's a clustering of more underlying bodily feelings. I have had these discussions with, in a sense, quote, the primary theorists of emotion, and basically have said to them in a very serious way, I said, why do you even need that construct? So think of emotion as a construct that sits on top of the physiology of regulating our body. And so we don't have specific signatures of every emotion, because emotions are really making meaning out of bodily feelings. It's on its way up to a higher cortical level. So, but it's all based upon the brain. Think of the brainstem as really being, having responsibility for regulating the homeostatic functions, and the brainstem can either support those functions or be shifted to support defense.
Let me ask a very specific question then. So based on what you're saying, if the vagal intake, the afferent information from the body is normal, whatever normal is, so normal, perfect, no threat, it's impossible theoretically then to have bad emotions.
Okay, so I didn't say impossible. I see, I would reverse it. So I've actually started to write about this, about the concept of feelings and homeostatic function. So if our autonomic nervous system is supporting our health, growth, and restoration, it creates that, let's call it a neural platform for more positive emotions, more expansive thinking, more problem solving. It's a platform for it. It doesn't determine, it's not sufficient. It's not a one-to-one. It's a one that is, it enables it. So in a sense, it's a hierarchical model. And I think what we've been lost.
As part of the input.
Yeah, I think we've been lost in, I would say, I was going to use the term overly optimistic viewpoint, but I really mean a distorted viewpoint in which there is a one-to-one mapping between thoughts and physiology, between emotions and physiology. But what happens is that the physiological, the palette for the physiological responses is relatively limited. But as you move up the brain gets more complex, right, and that palette just gets all over the place. So it's not like it lacks specificity and that's something bad. It lacks specificity because there are more general states, core states that underlie, let's say, mental health issues, underlying learning, inability to pay attention. They're core states, and they're not a signature of a specific process.
Wow. You know, I got to tell you, I've talked to you about it now for a number of years. This is a whole new way of thinking. I'm going to have to process all this. So I tried to keep my podcast to 30 minutes.
Oh.
But if you don't mind, maybe after I process it, I can have you back.
Oh, it would be my pleasure. Listen, Gene, I always enjoy talking to you. I've never slammed the door or hung up, so it's always a pleasure. And I mean, your journey with and what you've been doing and helping people through your work is really admirable. So I'm very respectful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, thanks.